This is the Heartland Daily Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Heartland's Tooth Daily Podcast. I'm Sterling Burnett, Heartland Research Fellow and Managing Editor of Environment and Climate News. I'm pleased to have as a guest today, a return guest, in fact, Mark Moreno. Mark is the publisher of the award-winning Climate Depot, a global warming and eco news center, a project of my friends at the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Mark and Climate Depot can fairly be considered one of the leading voices in the nation, if not the world, highlighting the shenanigans climate change alarmists get up to outside of the public view. Before starting Climate Depot, Mark worked for years in the belly of the beast, Congress. In response to the recent record cold across much of the country, especially in the northeastern U.S., former failed presidential candidate Al Gore took to Twitter to explain, amazingly, the recent bout of cold and snow is due to global warming. Imagine that. That absurd claim is what Mark's here to discuss today. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sterling. Happy to be here. Happy to join you again. It's been an active 2018 in the climate world, given that we're only not even 2 weeks in.
Yeah. Well, Mark, for our listeners who may not be familiar with you, CFACT, or Climate Depot, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to publish Climate Depot.
Okay, well, I'm not a scientist, but I occasionally play one on TV, I say with a smile. My background is politics and journalism. As an investigative reporter, I started out actually just doing a lot of environmental reporting. I actually did an Amazon rainforest documentary back that came out in 2000, in the year 2000. And I've always been interested in the environmental side. I worked for Cybercast News Service, part of Brent Bazell's Media Research Center. And then from there, I worked for Senator James Inhofe of the Environment and Public Works Committee. I was the communication director back about the time Al Gore's film came out, his first film. And I worked there for several years. And I actually wrote the 400 dissenting scientists report for the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, which was a huge consensus buster, if you will, report at the time. And then from my time in the U.S. Senate, working in the Senate committee, I went over to Climate Depot. And that's where I've been now since 2009. And I'm going on, I guess, wow, it's almost 9 years there. So I've been doing that, and Climate Depot has been a lot of fun. I go to all the United Nations conferences. I sometimes get thrown out of the United Nations conferences unceremoniously by armed UN climate cops. But I do special reports, media appearances. I've got to debate Bill Nye several times in primetime TV. And it's been a rollicking ride. And my big news, Sterling, is my book is coming out in next month, in February 2018, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change. Now, your listeners might be aware that The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism was written by Chris Horner back in 2007. Well, this is an all-new book, updated for 2018, and it's a completely different book. But it's the same series that Regnery Books publishes. So it's The Politically Incorrect Guide. It'll be the ultimate reference guide on climate from A to Z. And we tried to make it a lot of fun with a lot of little boxes and humor and pop culture. So it's not going to be a staid scientific book.
Well, Mark, before we go on to my next question, follow up a little bit. Tell us about, because this is important and I don't think enough people know about it. Tell us about the 400 scientists report you did for the Senate. What was it about?
Good. Yeah. In fact, yes, that was the genesis of that whole report. I started right when I actually saw Al Gore's film in May of 2006 before I went and worked in the United States Senate, a couple of weeks before. And I started there in the Senate. And that was the time the media was all over it. It was hyped, promoted. It was out that summer of 2006. I was working for Senator Inhofe. He was the chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee. Al Gore was saying publicly, the United Nations head was saying, Rajendra Pachauri of the climate panel, IPCC, was saying publicly that essentially there were no skeptics, maybe a dozen skeptics, the same number of people who believed that the moon landing was staged, believe global warming is not a crisis. And this was the message of the media. And all that year just getting pounded, our office was getting pounded. Inhofe was giving speeches, trying to highlight some of the scientists who spoke out against it. But we were getting, I guess you could say, just pounded incessantly about all scientists agree. And literally this point, it was actually Andrew Dessler, who was writing for Grist magazine. He's from Texas A&M. He's a global warming activist scientist. He just kept saying over and over that there's, you know, he doesn't even think there were two dozen legitimate climate skeptic scientists who were skeptical of the man-made global warming narrative. So that challenge is in my head. So I did a whole proposal for the United States Senate Environment and Public Works Committee about how we would put out a call for scientists, gather information. And in 2007, the next year, we were able to gather, and Inhofe actually gave speeches and talked about it. And I put out feelers and I started researching, investigating. We got over 400 international scientists. Many of them had sent in their statements to us. Others we found and culled from reports and other interviews. We put it all together in their own words with their bios and their peer-reviewed publications and everything. And we combined it into with official Senate seal of the committee. We released that in 2007, and all hell broke loose, Sterling. We had, starting with the Drudge Report and getting on that, and then getting international media around the world, U.S. Senate report, 400 dissenting scientists, challenge Al Gore and the United Nations. It was a seminal moment. I remember Chris Horner even telling me at the time that Bill O'Reilly, who was weakening and sounding a lot like Al Gore, when our report came out on Fox News, even Bill O'Reilly started saying, well, there's a lot of prominent scientists who disagree. We were highlighting Nobel Prize winning scientists, former UN scientists. And it was a report heard around the world. We had climate scientists talking about how they just accepted the consensus and actually put this in the report. Since that report came out shortly after, they were actually questioning why they just accepted the UN's word on it. And then we started highlighting as a follow-up many of the left-wing scientists who weren't buying it and finally were speaking out. So then we updated it to 650 and then over 700. And finally, I retired from collecting the names at over 1,000. Now, this was a report, again, these were scientists who were specifically speaking out at that moment. A little bit different than like Art Robinson. He had the petition of 30,000, 50,000. That was just like a paragraph petition and people signed on. This was different. My report was different for the Senate, for Senator Inhofe, because this allowed the scientists in their own words with the full range of disciplines and different ways of skepticism that way you'd have a solar scientist talking about the sun's influence. You'd have ocean scientists talking about the oceans. You'd have geologists speaking about the history of the earth. You would have other scientists who study clouds talk about it. So it gave you a much rich, full perspective, and it was a powerful report, and that is what basically propelled me on to Climate Depot as well. And that report we kept updating every year with hundreds of new scientists.
So you got up to 1,000, but I think the last one that was published, maybe I'm wrong, was 700 scientists.
Well, the last one, the good question, that was published in the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works. But shortly after I left and started Climate Depot, I did one final update with the Senate and Climate Depot and worked with Inhofe's office, too. And then we actually broke 1,000, and that's when I retired. But I published it at Climate Depot, and Inhofe made note of it as well, though, in the Senate.
And how do you think that holds up over time?
Well, it's amazingly holds up over time. Unfortunately, there's a little thing called death. So a lot of the older scientists, there's a certain collection I was keeping track for years how many have died. I no longer update that. Not huge numbers, but at least dozens, now that I know of that, some of the names as they got older. But it holds up very well. Many of the scientists skeptical beginning that we collected the names in 2007 are still very vocal now and still very skeptical, and actually were featured in the film Climate Hustle, which we did, which was released last year to 400 theaters and is now on DVD and at Amazon and iTunes and all that. So it's held up very well. The media has always, tried to attack it, and I had to withstand a lot of brutal attacks on it. But it's interesting, like they would go after TV weathermen and meteorologists that had the AMS seal. They say, well, these aren't really climate experts. But at the same time, they would always tout any meteorologist who towed the line as some kind of climate expert who was important. But if you found skeptical ones, they'd say, oh, well, that's just a TV meteorologist. So you played all those games. But it was a powerful report, again, because it was name after name after name after name. And a lot of them had UN affiliations or had resigned from the UN. A lot of them were Nobel Prize winning. They were from prestigious institutions and universities from around the world, from Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, MIT, University of London. I mean, we just had them from everywhere. And then we kept collecting them because people would hear about the list, and scientists from Australia and even Africa would say, hey, put me on the list. And you know, it was an amazing thing. We just kept collecting the names.
Well, moving on sort of to the topic of our of our conversation, I just thought that was important to highlight. As we rang in the new year on January 1st, the average temperature for the continental United States was a bone-chilling 11 degrees Fahrenheit, with more than 85% of the country experiencing below freezing temperatures and nearly one-third of the nation facing temperatures 0 degrees or lower. What was Al Gore's Twitter response to basically the powerful arrival of winter?
So Al Gore tried to do, he got Michael Mann, the ClimateGate professor, the infamous hockey stick creator, or inventor, we don't say, yeah. But he got him to write an article and an analysis for Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. So Al Gore touted his own article, and Al Gore's quote was, this record cold is completely consistent with what you would expect of the climate crisis. In other words, Al Gore in 2018 was now on record as saying, they expected record cold, blizzards. The East Coast, we've had the snowiest decade on record since 2010, this decade, and we're not even finished with the decade. Al Gore now says that's all consistent. After, in his 2006 film, first of all, warning about the snows of Kilimanjaro disappearing. Second of all, never once mentioning that record cold and future record snowfalls would be a consequence of global warming. Also, his sequel, Al Gore didn't mention sequel from 2017 didn't mention that global warming was going to cause record snowfalls and record cold. So this was an issue that Al Gore, after the fact, is now trying to take credit for, but nothing he'd said prior to that had warned about record cold and snow. And this was the new thing. What it basically, in the article that Al Gore referred to, was by Michael Mann, and it's a whole polar vortex theory that global warming is altering the jet stream and the cold air is leaving the Arctic and coming down. The problem with that is that whole theory was just overturned a few days ago. Even Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press, who has a complete bias toward global warming, fear mongering, and is one of the worst mainstream media reporters on this issue. He has flashes of fairness and flashes of being good sometimes, but overall he's just an agenda-driven Associated Press reporter. But even he couldn't swallow Al Gore's pill and did a whole article touting that it was essentially natural variability and it just happens and it was unusual luck and this is how we got this cold weather. And he said it was not caused by global warming, and he pointed to other analysis. So when Al Gore loses the resident sycophant Seth Borenstein at the Associated Press, it was a pretty big deal. But this has been going on for years on every issue of the climate debate. When something doesn't go their way, they claim it's exactly as we would have expected. In fact, recently, in the same time frame, in early January 2018, Sterling, sea level, according to NASA and others, is actually leveling off and may even be a slight drop. They're usually temporary blips and they continue, but there's no acceleration of sea level in recent years. So what they've come out with, and I mean they, meaning the climate establishment and universities, their new narrative talking point is the ocean floor is sinking, and that's swallowing the glacier melt and the sea level rise. So the seas aren't rising because the ocean is sinking. And this is one of their excuses. At one point, they had 60-plus excuses about the global warming pause. And then guess what? So they got tired of talking about the temperature pause from 1997-98 until current time. So they went back first in the surface data at NOAA, and they erased it. They went back and redid the numbers and erased the historical pause, and so it looked like it was gone. And then they went to the RSS satellite feed, and they erased the pause in that as well by altering the past numbers. So this is what they do, whether it's altering predictions and saying it's consistent or actually altering data. This is what we are faced with in the current state of the global warming debate.
If you missed Heartland's latest climate conference, the 12th International Conference on Climate Change held in Washington, D.C. this year, you missed one of our best. It featured key members of President Trump's transition team for climate policy, including Myron E. Bell and Steve Malloy, who set the groundwork for reforming the Environmental Protection Agency, transforming it from a bureaucracy that stifles economic growth at the service of the eco-left into one that serves the best interests of Americans while also protecting the environment. The conference also featured climate change awards to Senator John Barrasso, a forecasting pioneer in J. Scott Armstrong, Apollo 7 astronaut and American hero Walt Cunningham, and presentations by some of the leading scientists on the climate, including Will Happer, Fred Singer, Willie Soon, Ben Zeiker, and Ross McKittrick. We had 38 speakers in all. And here's the good news. You can watch every one of these presentations at your leisure. Just visit Heartland's special archive site for all of our climate conferences. Go to climateconferences.heartland.org to view them on your computer or any mobile device. And if you have a smart TV, you can search for these videos on YouTube using ICCC12, that's 1I, 3Cs, and the number 12 as a keyword. Learn more about the scientific basis for climate realism and share these videos with your friends. Visit climateconferences.heartland.org.
As I used to point out, I've written a few articles about how this is really a religion, it's not science. And you know that because there's nothing that would disprove the theory.
Exactly.
If there's more rain, it's global warming. If there's less rain, it's global warming. If there's higher snowfall, it's global warming. If there's lower snowfall, it's global warming. More hurricanes, global warming. Fewer hurricanes, global warming. And that's not science. Science is the idea that you put forward a theory and then you put forward the conditions against which you could test it and see if it's true. And you can't have diametrically opposed conclusions as to what could be happening.
Yes. In fact, in my book and in the film Climate Hustle, we go through this, and if you go to Climate Depot, you can find this. Literally, you mentioned hurricanes, a classic example. The new normal is Hurricane Katrina. Then we go through this huge drought. Then they say, well, global warming is going to be less hurricanes but more intense. And then, there you go. Harvey explains that. They go through this whole thing, but yet the historical record still shows the hurricanes were worse and were actually on a decline of big hurricanes. But they'll claim that that's it, whether you're talking about malaria, sea level rise, a whole host of other extreme weather, they actually predict opposite ones. In fact, snow was a great one to look at. They predicted back in the 90s, snow would be a thing of the past, that children wouldn't know what snow is. These are like UN scientists affiliated with the University of East Anglia. Other UN scientists like Michael Oppenheimer told the New York Times he bought his daughter a sled and there'd be no more snow. Well, there was also studies at that time predicting an increase in snow due to global warming, a couple anyway. So once we had the blizzard 2010 and all the record snows started, and again, we've had many mega storms, a guy named George Monbiot in the UK, an environmental writer, climate activist, started digging up these old studies and basically just ignored all the studies that said there'd be less snow, including the United Nations who predicted it, including Al Gore, including Michael Oppenheimer, UN lead author, scientist, and said focused it on a couple of obscure studies that said, ha-ha, we predicted it, but we just didn't pay attention to those predictions. So in other words, you get both predictions. They can credibly say, you can go back in the record, find credible predictions of less snow due to global warming, and you can now find predictions of more snow. Same thing with malaria, same thing with hurricanes, same thing with even now the record cold they're claiming. So in a way, imagine if you went to Vegas and you bet on both teams to win, and then you tried to claim yourself the big winner. That's what they're doing with science. And in a way, it's actually plausible in the sense that, yes, it is. They are actually pointing to a study that predicted – there were studies, a few that predicted to be more snow due to global warming. But they weren't the ones that anyone was talking about. They weren't affiliated with the United Nations, and they weren't – hyped by the media and the prominent climate scientists and activists like Al Gore. So the point is they predict both outcomes. They got themselves covered. They just forget about the ones that fall to the wayside and go with whatever the momentary weather is that they can now claim that they're linking to global warming.
Well, I mean, that's what they do with climate models. They say one climate model. Yeah. I remember when they did the regional they looked at the U.S. and they did a regional analysis of what could happen in the U.S. And one of the climate models they chose showed the Great Lakes would fall, and the other one said they would rise. One climate model said we'd have more rain and more flooding in the desert southwest, and one said it would be more arid. Well, you're covered both ways. And what happens
exactly.
is, if one model predicts the Great Lakes to fall, and it falls, they point to that model. But if the same model says there should be more rain in the Southwest and there's less, they just point to the other model. You know, it's whack-a-mole is what it is.
It is. And the modeling is a classic example of how they also can say one of their tactics is to say it's worse than we thought. The climate is getting much worse. You're like, well, wait a minute. Temperatures have still not shown anything. Even the hottest year claims are within the margin of error. So it's a fancy way of saying the pause continues. Polar bear numbers are at record number levels. Sea levels not accelerating or even dropping. And so much so that they're coming up with, oh, the ocean floor is sinking. And then you can go through all these lists. Extreme weather is at historical lows, even with Hurricane Harvey, Maria, et cetera. And then they say, well, how is it? You can ask them, how is it worse than we thought? And their answer, Sterling, is, as you just said, models. They'll say, well, our predictions now of 2050 and 2075 are much more dire than our predictions of those years just 3 years ago. So it's worse than we thought. Oh, sorry. It's worse than you thought because you're making scarier and scarier predictions of the future, even though the real world data is contradicting everything you're claiming currently. And they'll say, yes, that's how it works. So and that's a misdirection, too. When you get reports out, you know, that we have record low tornadoes now for, you know, at or near record low tornadoes the last 5 years. Global droughts on a decline on, you know, 50 plus year timescales. California's drought much worse in previous centuries, not even close to the scale that they had. You go through all these things, big hurricanes still down despite the bad year of 2017. And they'll say, well, it's still worse than we thought because, you know, we're making these predictions of the future. And this is all the media eats this stuff up. They lap it up when they come up with these scary predictions. You know, new prediction out, dire global warming, the Earth, you know, the most recent one a couple of days ago, the most of the Earth will become a desert. It'll be this drying out of the Earth. And then, of course, the article only says like 25% of the Earth. The study says 25% of the Earth. The media loves to hype it and go with it a lot worse. And this is how, again, let me give you a quick example about how it's tied to funding. If you're a butterfly scientist at a university and no one's paying attention to the fate of butterflies in the American Southwest, and you're trying to get attention, money, fame, and book deals and magazine articles written, what do? You decide, hey, I'm going to do a speculative, if-then, model-based study on the future fate of butterflies in the American Southwest. So you do a study. You've done nothing wrong as a scientist. You're going through models, and you're coming up with three scenarios. One, the butterflies are not affected. You know, you assume a big temperature increase, like 3 degrees in, say, 75 years. And then you come up with scenarios, butterflies not too affected, butterflies pretty badly affected, and then butterflies catastrophically affected under these scenarios. And you put all your caveats in your paper, you get it published. Suddenly your university, and I actually have in my book, Sterling, scientists who admit that they spend as much time or more time on the press release for their scientific studies than the actual scientific study did itself. Now, why would a scientist admit that, and why would they do that? The answer is, if a climate alarmist study is released and the media doesn't make a fuss about it, no one will fund the next one. So that, you know, that's what happens. So what happens is this theoretical butterfly scientist gets all the university gets a hold of it. They do a big press release. Butterflies doomed in the American Southwest. Suddenly you got the New York Times writing about it, the Associated Press. It's on CBS News. More bad news on global warming. The consensus grows stronger. A new study in the journal shows that butterflies are doomed in the American Southwest. The butterfly, which has survived eons, is now under the new study, is likely to be wiped out by the year 2080, you know, if nothing is done to stop global warming. Now, the scientist didn't do anything wrong. He came up with a couple different model scenarios. He did an if-then study. But this scientist never once looked at whether CO2 influences temperature or how it does. Suddenly that scientist, the butterfly scientist, who knows nothing about carbon, who'd ever studied carbon dioxide, is now part of the 97% consensus. His study is now part of all the studies that support global warming. And he is now getting massive media attention, interviews. He's going to get big grants. He's going to get staff. His university is going to like him. And guess what he's going to do next? He's not going to do a study on the mating habits of butterflies. He's going to do more climate butterfly studies because that's where the money is. That's where the money's pouring in from governments, foundations, universities. And this is how you create the illusion that all scientists agree that all this is a crisis and that there's no disagreement even among the peer-reviewed literature. This is how insane this whole global warming establishment has become.
Well, Mark, let me give you a real-world example of that. I was on a panel with a couple of climate scientists and some engineers and some others. We were debating climate change, and they got this one climate scientist who they expected to be sort of on the alarmist side, and instead they were surprised to find out he wasn't. And they said, well, you've
written... Scott Denning you're talking about? Or...
No. This is another scientist. I'm not...
Okay.
And he said, they said, well, you've written these studies that look at climate change and the effect of on agriculture. He was an agriculture scientist. And he said, well, that's right. But what I found out was that's how I get research dollars. Wanted to do a study. He was looking at agriculture along a dormant volcano in Mexico. And the crops had been failing. The poor farmers were facing crop failure pretty regularly. And he wanted to research why. Now, he had a theory as to why. He thought it was because the agricultural practices, slash and burn agriculture, was going higher and higher up the mountain. The black soot was falling upon the glacier, which provided the water for the agriculture, and it was melting the glacier. But he said, I'm afraid, you know, he says, but in my research grant proposal, I said, I want to study whether climate change and rising temperatures on the peak of this mountain are causing the crop failure. And he got funding from mountaineer groups, he got funding from agriculture groups, got funding from tourism groups, and he got government grants because he was looking at... Now, he knew, he'd already seen the data, that in fact temperatures hadn't changed on the peak of this mountain at all. And sure enough, it confirmed what his initial hypothesis was. But he says every time he does a research grant, he ties it to climate change somehow, because that's how he's going to get the money, even if it comes to a conclusion that it's not climate change causing the problem.
And this is how you get the narrative of the day. It's the science funding that drives what all these scientists are going to be doing. And again, it's not that they're finding horrible things in the current data necessarily, although they can always find something. Oh, we found this area here. This is a 1-in-1,000-year flood. This would not happen without climate change. And it turns out those were insurance, and this is all in my book detailed, how these were just insurance things that they built up. And a 1,000-year flood or a 100-year flood isn't what you think it is. And if you look at it, you can actually compare it to the lottery. It'd be like the way they do this, the scientists and the media and the data with a lot of this extreme weather. They'll say, this is unbelievable. Look at this over here. There's a 1-in-500-year flood. The odds of you winning the lottery are very low. The odds of someone somewhere winning the lottery are 100%. Basically, someone's going to win the lottery somewhere. So what ends up happening is it's the scientists and the media hyping every lottery winner as an example. Look, you too can be a winner. Well, in extreme weather, it's like, look, there's a bad weather event here. Look at this happened here. Can you believe this? A record is going to be broken somewhere always. It's the nature of our planet. It's the nature of our unbelievably good monitoring system that we didn't even have 40 years ago. And this is how they do it. I liken it to that lottery winner because – they're hyping all these extreme events as though they're unusual and all that, but you can always find an extreme event somewhere, just like you can always find a slot winner or a lottery winner and give the impression that everyone can be a winner, or give the impression in the case of climate that this is coming to you. And then this on the same token, Sterling, leads to the funding thing. We have the New York City mayor, the SUD driving New York City mayor, now trying to go after and sue, with the help of climate activists, energy companies like ExxonMobil and others, for individual storms. In other words, if you're the governor of New York and you have a tornado outbreak in upstate New York in the summer, you can now say ExxonMobil is 25% liable for causing it. We're going to sue you. It's a shakedown technique, and this is where the whole new thing is coming. They're going to use this speculative, bastardized science on extreme weather when, again, extreme weather, the only actual science – shows that it's way down and it's not following any trend of global warming predictions, that there's nothing unusual going on with the weather. But now every bad weather event, they're going to be trying to shake down energy companies. And who knows, given all the judges out there, I wouldn't be surprised if judges started ruling in their favor. I have no faith in our judicial system, certainly when it comes to climate.
Well, I mean, you know, I can't get into the details of that case, but my first response if I was Exxon is – when you stop using our product and contributing to the problem that you claim is being caused, then we'll worry about it. But as long as you're still driving gasoline-powered vehicles and using natural gas for electricity in your state, you, not the producer, but the user is causing the problem, and so you're at fault. That would be my response. But let's get back to the topic at hand. When Gore made this ludicrous statement that warming was causing more snow, it came, just as you mentioned, a few years, not long ago, multiple scientists and politicians were saying we would soon see no winter, that children would not know what snow looked like and would have to ask their parents what it was like when there was snow. Now these same people are saying climate is causing snow, but some good climate scientists, including meteorologist Joe Bastardi, Dr. Roger Pelkey Sr., one of the leading climate alarmists, Kevin Trenberth, this one surprised me, scientist with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Cliff Mass of Washington State's climatologist, you listed them all on your Climate Depot site and quoted them saying that this is not climate change causing cold, that man's claim is absurd, that this is weather.
Yeah, my favorite quote was meteorologist Joe Bastardi, the long-range forecaster. He actually said, it's witchcraft. He said it's, quote, flat-out insanity to tell the public that events that have occurred countless times before, the record cold, with no climate change attribution, are now – and to say they're now climate change, he says it's not science, it's witchcraft. No proof at all. He calls it climate ambulance chasing, which is exactly what it is. It's a way to get a cheap headline, a cheap interview, and get your university happy, if in the case of Michael Mann, and just it's a way of just to get out there. And this goes on now, not just with the winter storms, as we've said, but with every hurricane, with droughts, wildfires. That was the most recent example before this cold weather, certainly was the wildfires, and actually found the charts showing that the wildfires of the 19th century were much worse. And wildfires are not a great climate indicator because so much of wildfire depends on land use, development, and a whole host of the ways that governments interact with the land and allow trees and clearing, and it's not just rain patterns and other things. So that's actually one of the weakest arguments to even try to tie wildfires at all. But even if you do, it shows the past was much, much worse than any recent wildfire.
But sticking to the snow, though. Sticking to the snow.
Yes.
So tell us what Cliff Mass said, because I thought his was the best. You know, you thought Bastardi had a good quote. I thought Cliff Mass pretty much dismantled it.
Yeah, Cliff Mass, he's a University of Washington climatologist. He said they make no sense. They're inconsistent with observations, these kind of claims. Cold waves have actually decreased during the past 50 years, not increased. Now, if this were the case that Al Gore was claiming, if they were expecting cold wave like this, how could they, based on the data, if they're decreasing? Now, interestingly enough, you don't have to go back 50 years. You can just go back 1940 to 1980 was a cooling period, and then we warmed from 1980 to, say, 1997. And now, you know, we've been in sort of this long pause with maybe now a slight warming trend if you count last year's El Nino. So it just depends on where you are in terms of what timelines you want to use on the data. But Cliff Mass clearly points out this was not – the case, and he goes through and mocks the idea that every winter reignites the global warming debate. And John Holdren is one of the ones that actually got us into this by doing this whole thing on the polar vortex, basing it on this climate. I like to – as Joe Bastardi says, a climate ambulance station. Jennifer Francis. There's a whole movement that's not just snow, Sterling, but they're now saying any individual storm, they're going to be able to figure out the human climate component to them. And again, I think this is all tied now to this whole movement with its state's attorney generals and mayors to start suing energy companies and shaking them down. They need some kind of formula based on models where they can say ExxonMobil was, you know, 30% responsible for this tornado outbreak and 25% responsible for this. They tried to do it with Hurricane Harvey, and now they're trying to do it with cold and snow. And Al Roker, by the way, was one of the biggest ones 2 years ago in the Boston had their record snows when they had snow piled up six stories high. And he was actually saying that he thinks this is global warming, and that's why he doesn't like the phrase climate change. Yeah, he doesn't like the phrase global warming. He likes climate change because it's a more catch-all phrase. This is where we are with the current state of the science. Every weather event, including the cold and snow, is proof.
Yeah. It seems to me, Mark, that whether the issue is polar bears, hurricanes, record cold, you know, whatever, Gore, Mann, and others are repeatedly climbing out on these unstable limbs, making untenable assertions, and then sawing off the limb behind them because what their prediction is refuted by actual data, and then they turn around and say just the opposite. You've already talked about that a little bit, but you know, big picture, if you can make just one point, what's the most important single point about the state of the climate change debate you'd like our listeners to take away from our discussion today?
Well, the key point about this whole thing is, even if you believe mankind has had a warming influence on the climate, and you know, Roy Spencer, climatologist, could say, I think that my analysis from talking to all the scientists, what I think of consensus, Dr. Fred Singer, atmospheric physicist, has said, yes, man has an influence on the climate, but you can't distinguish it from natural variability. And that's the bottom line. So even if you accept mankind has a noticeable or discernible, here's where I think people need to understand. No UN treaty or EPA climate regulations or carbon tax is going to change the weather, the storms, or any other part of climate that you can think of. So the idea that's being sold by the United Nations, by former President Obama's EPA, that we have to pass EPA regulations because the storms are getting worse, we need the UN treaty because we've got to save the planet. Even if you believe humans can have an influence on climate, none of this other stuff makes sense, especially when you look at it from the point of view of, you know, the best you can do is stabilize emissions, and that's not even going to have – there's been reports by National Academy of Sciences saying it's already too late. So it all shows you, if you're a believer in the alarmist point of view, it's already too late. So this is a it's an issue where people actually believe – and Joe Bastardi used the word witchcraft earlier – they actually believe that they can pass legislation to the UN or Congress or EPA or some, or their EU – and alter Earth's temperature and change the storminess and patterns and lower the sea level rise. And that is what I think, if we can, as skeptics, keep emphasizing that point, is that governments can't alter sea level. I mean, you can through development projects, but you can't alter it by controlling emissions. My favorite quote in this whole debate, Sterling, is from Robert Gegengack, the former chair of the University of Pennsylvania, that said, none of the proposals offered by the United Nations, the EPA, that anyone's even contemplated, would have any impact on the climate system if, in fact, it were controlled by CO2. In other words, it's just a useless political exercise, even if you believe that CO2 is controlling the climate right now. And that is what I just find shocking, that people, otherwise intelligent people, actually think that the EPA regulations or a UN treaty is going to save us if we face a catastrophe.
Mark, I think that sums it up well. We've been pleased you could join us today. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and our listeners.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed being here. And I look forward to it again. And again, the Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change will be out by Regnery Books. You can look it up on Amazon right now. It's available Barnes & Noble, and it'll be coming to bookstores and available online.
I'm sure if you get us a review copy, I'm sure we'll review it in Environment and Climate News.
Yes, we're still a while away, maybe another month before I have review copies, but thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks for checking in on us today. Please check Heartland's website as we follow the work of Mark Morano and Climate Depot, and as we track the progress of energy and environmental laws and regulations that affect you. And go frequently to our PolicyBot site, your one-stop shop for free market solutions to public policy problems. In addition, if you're not already receiving these podcasts daily on your favorite device, go to iTunes and subscribe, and when you have the time, please rate our podcast on iTunes so you can help us expand the reach of free market ideas. Thanks. Take care. Bye.